Welcome back to the roundtable. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this morning. I am Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. And as ever, you can join the conversation today by emailing panel@wamc.org. That is the correct and best email to use to comment on the stories or ask questions of the panelists. Again, panel@wamc.org. Today, our panelists are Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Good
How
morning.
How are you?
Sarah. Well, I was good until it started to snow this morning. So I'm certainly ready for spring. I just want to note for our listeners that today is Emancipation Act Day. So on April 16th of 1862, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation freeing slaves. And I think as a country that we should continue to tell our history honestly and reflect on errors in the past that we should not replicate in the present. So important day in our history today.
Emancipation Day, lo, those many years ago, but also not that far back in time when you think about it.
Not at all.
Also joining us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, opinions her own, Nick Rangel. Good morning, Nick.
Thanks for clarifying, opinions my own.
Opinions your own.
I got caught in that snow squall walking my girls this morning. So I was like, what is this? No, it's fake spring.
What time was it snowing? I think I may
6:30, have... 6:37.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe I was already here and just missed it. Well, it's okay. I know what it looks like. Snow. Also, coming in on a steed of any color to save us this morning as we had a last-minute scratch, Mark Whitman, investment banker on Wall Street, joining us by phone. Good morning, Mark. Thank you for being the last-minute third and our hero for the morning.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Happy to be here. You know how it works. Anytime you tell me I need to do something, you're the boss.
I'm glad that you think that, and I appreciate you acting on that belief with regularity. Thanks for being here. Again, the email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org. And we will begin this morning with a conversation about the White House's current approach to their reporting corps. The White House is ending a regular reporting slot for independent newswires, this copy from the New York Times. The Trump administration said yesterday that it will no longer reserve a regular slot in the presidential press pool for three independent newswires that have participated for decades. This is including the Associated Press, Bloomberg News, and Reuters. The move is the latest effort by the White House to exert more control over the dedicated press corps that reports on its day-to-day activities. It is also a new wrinkle in an unfolding legal battle with the AP, whose journalists have been barred for the past 2 months from covering small-scale events with the president. A federal judge said last week that the White House has to restore full access to AP journalists, ruling that the administration's ban amounted to a violation of the First Amendment. The White House has appealed, and a hearing is set for tomorrow, so there will be updates tomorrow. The presidential press pool, to clarify, is a small rotating group of reporters who are granted access to more intimate events with the president, such as Oval Office receptions, they relay the proceedings to other journalists and the broader public. It's a logistical accommodation for smaller spaces that cannot fit dozens of reporters and an opportunity for journalists to interact up close with the president and ask him, I also want to say, or her, if there ever is a female president, direct questions. In February, breaking decades of bipartisan precedent, the administration said it would begin handpicking the members of the pool, wresting control from the independent White House Correspondents Association, which has, of course, decried the move. Yesterday, the White House press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, released a more specific set of guidelines for the press pool, including the elimination of a slot reserved for journalists representing one of three major newswires. Again, that's AP, Bloomberg News, and Reuters. That slot in the rotation, Ms. Leavitt said, will instead be filled by an additional journalist from a print media outlet selected from a rotation of several dozen. Reporters at the three newswires are still eligible to fill the print media slot, but they will no longer be granted access to these sorts of presidential events on a near daily basis. Bob.
So this is another effort by the government to control what we the citizens are able to hear from the free press. I mean, this is just a blatant attack on the free press. And for folks at home saying, oh, here he goes again, he's, you know, complaining about the administration, let me sort of frame for you why this is so important. If access to the president is controlled according to this sort of mythical process that they're now going to run, that means that the people who are able to travel with the president and see changes in his cognitive ability, in his physical state, being able to ask him hard questions, it is reduced or eliminated. In fact, what happens, and it's human nature, right, is that you're going to want to continue to have a place on the plane. So you're going to play with the administration rather than ask the hard questions that the press needs to ask in order to protect the democracy. So this, to me, is a great example of the continued efforts to funnel press through accepted propaganda outlets. And we see this in many ways. We see this in control of who has access to the president, who is able to ask questions, what questions are being asked when the pool reporters are actually shouting at the president. I mean, he's got an incredibly selective hearing. But it's also in a pattern that I've picked up where certain news outlets are being used by the administration to float hit jobs that are then being used as an example of gotcha stories. So there are stories coming out in tabloids that are claiming that there's illegal behavior coming out of particularly state leadership. You know, we've seen it with Letitia James. We've certainly seen it with Newsom. We've seen hit jobs on those politicians who are considered to be enemies of the state, and it's being recycled from something like one journal to Fox picking it up. And then all of a sudden it gains steam because multiple media outlets are now picking this story up, which says that there's something there. And when you are able to, back at the White House, clip off the access to the people who actually would question the validity of this, it's becoming an echo chamber. And again, This is another page out of the authoritarian playbook. It's control of the press.
Nick?
Yeah, and I think what my colleague is saying is by removing journalists who are credible, who have journalistic integrity, who have the credentials of journalism, we're going to lose out on the impartial, the accurate, the more independent news reporting that is crucial for understanding and knowing what's going on at the federal level and with our federal administration. And it does start to dismantle the trust in the press even further. I mean, I think there's been a ton of damage. And it also starts to leverage more power in bodies that are not journalists, right? You start to see the podcasters, the pod bros, running with a story that gets published by the New York Post with, you know, very few details, very little evidence, very few facts. And then that becomes a news cycle out of thin air, out of very little. And we know that if there's nothing to fill in the gaps with real investigation, with real research, with data, that can have a tremendous impact on a person's career and on their own ability to kind of combat that narrative.
Mark Whitman.
Hey, Sarah. I think you have to look at what the administration's doing here and just take a deep breath and look at the motivation versus the result. The motivation here is clearly to punish the AP because they won't call the Gulf of Mexico whatever it is Trump decided he wants to call it. And I think the AP's right in standing firm in that case. I think the court was right in telling the administration that they can't exclude the AP from a certain level of press access because the administration is trying to regulate the AP speech. I think that's pretty clear. Here, I actually think this was a clever riposte on the part of the administration. Because aside from the AP issue, if the administration had said, look, we're taking one of the slots that's available to reporters on an ongoing basis, and we're going to broaden the eligibility for it to reflect the changing media landscape, I don't think that in and of itself, if it had been done without this motivation to punish the AP, I don't think that's necessarily something I'm going to jump up and down about. I think Trump is amply available. I mean, frankly, if you look at him compared to his predecessor, it's a heck of a lot easier on a daily basis to monitor his mental and physical state than it obviously was with his predecessor. And I also think the media landscape is changing, whether or not we like all of the new outlets. I do think the White House generally, no matter who occupies it, should be responsive to that. So the problem is that the White House isn't doing this today because they want to broaden the types of outlets that they're covered by. They want to do this because this is a populist, authoritarian president, and he wants to continue to punish the AP. So it'll be an interesting question for the courts. I suspect that the courts really, because what Trump is doing in and of itself in isolation, i.e. reassigning that slot, isn't breaking the law. I don't think the courts, I'd be surprised to see the courts stand in the way of it just because the motivation is so poor. And I'm not that worried. I think there's plenty enough outlets that have access to Trump that are going to tell us the truth, that I don't worry about the reassignment of one particular slot in this case.
Yeah, Mark, I appreciate your position. I guess what bothers me is that these are all important but small steps that, taken individually, look, I don't like it, but I'm going to shrug it off. But the long-term impact and effect is going to be pretty dramatic. So you don't stand up for AP right now and say, oh, okay, well, we can say and explain what they're doing right now. You know, I'm not going to protest this. But what happens when the rest of the press pool, in order to keep their access, starts to change what they report? Okay, and what, you know, what happens to the overall trust in government when you don't even know who to turn to get news anymore? And I think part of the problem with government right now, and a lot of the distrust certainly that I'm feeling towards the government, is I don't trust anything coming out of the administration, and honestly, I question anything that I'm seeing on, even within the mainstream media, because I feel like they're pulling punches. And I think a great example was a couple of weeks ago that, you know, the level of reporting on what I thought was a pretty massive event across the nation, where 5-6 million people turned out to say, hey, wait a second, hands off our services. But if you look at how that was covered, it was treated as a non-event. By a lot of the mainstream press, and I think it was done because it was, they're purposely not, they're trying not to be the focus of the ire of an administration that will misuse the levers of government to punish them. And the same thing as we're seeing in academia, right? I mean, going after Columbia and then going after Harvard is purposely meant to chill the rest of academia, knowing that if you could club the major universities in this country, then what does everybody else do? And each one of these chips away at our basic civil rights. And I will put this out for conversation. How do we get this back?
Well, and at the same time, right, the administration is threatening CBS and 60 Minutes for its reporting, its deep dive on Ukraine, on our entanglement with Greenland. I'm going to call it an entanglement.
and Greenland so would like it to be very much an unentanglement.
Unentangled.
Yeah, but I know what you mean.
And so it's in combination. So not only is the press being limited access to Trump largely because the administration doesn't want to have to answer hard-hitting questions, right? Like, they are trying to protect themselves. But I think in some ways they're also trying to protect the president from hearing hard things, right? And there's been some analysis around his mindset and not wanting to hear criticism and not wanting to be challenged in a way that, like, impacts or affects his own, I don't know, ego, I guess. But so in addition to limiting access to the press, to, I think we'll see, we'll know more when we know who gets that slot. Like, what does the new rotation look like? You know, is Joe Rogan coming in? Like, and then also attacks on other kinds of press outlets and investigatory stories at, you know, like 60 Minutes.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will speak about this a bit more and share some of your letters after a newscast from the BBC. The panel this morning, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Mark Whitman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue this morning, joined by the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Investment Banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. We have some email on the topic that we were discussing before the break, which is the White House's current approach to eliminating positions in the press pool for certain news outlets. This is from Neil, who says, "The Associated Press is particularly important because it serves newspapers and broadcast stations around the country and around the world that do not have their own reporters in the White House or even in Washington. Sharing the news is the very reason for its existence. And by the way, this is a nonprofit organization owned by companies that use its services." That's from Neil, a good point about the AP. Erica writes in and says, "The media plays a big role in our politics, but the ego-driven actors in this administration will give us all the news we need. You can't stop information from getting out when all you want to do is brag about your accomplishments and whisper about your misdoings. We know everything this administration is doing, and I don't think we will be in the dark about this. Yes, it has future ramifications, but this guy is 80. What do we think about Erica's take on their ability to...
I think you're
obscure.
Right, but I think with this super successful strategy of flooding the zone, that there's so much raw sewage being dumped on our head on a daily basis that we're not able to focus on any specific issue. So let me give you a perfect example of where I think it's really dangerous. Okay. Trump comes out and makes a statement that should never have been uttered by any American, that he thinks it's okay to send American citizens to foreign prisons. Think about that comment. Okay, there should have been mass outrage. There should have been congressional inquiries. There should have been a huge pushback, but there isn't. Right, because it's all part of it's all lost in tariffs, and it's all lost in Greenland, and it's all lost in the silliness from Bondi and Hesketh and all of these people. So this is, in my mind, a trial balloon of potential policies to see how it's going to be reacted to, and this is where as a country, I think we need to be, while we need to be patriotic, we also need to question the government. Part of our responsibility as citizens of this country is to question the government. And if the very people who are going to sort of be the canaries in the coal mine and raise issues for us are unable, unwilling to, then that's going to create both a chilling effect on people's willingness to stand up against tyranny, but also understand when their rights are being siphoned from them. And that's exactly what's happening.
Mark Whitman? Mark, are you there? You may be muted.
I indeed was. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's okay.
I bet it was brilliant, though, Mark.
Bob, I think the flooding the zone reference actually points out, in my mind, why it is we need to be really careful about the list of complaints that we lodge against the administration. I think this action on their part is likely legal, and I think we ought to, once the courts sort it out, we ought to leave it be, because there are far more things to object to specifically, and you enumerated many of them. I also think the argument that the Trump administration is interacting with the press in a way so as to curry favor by granting access and encourage media outlets to take up stories that the administration believes is important. I believe that that's always taken place, and that the burden lies on us, the public, to discern what that relationship looks like and to hold a lens to everything that we read and see in the media, read, see, and hear in the media, to adjust for that relationship that's always existed. So again, I don't disagree that the reason the Trump administration is doing this is for bad motivations, but we live life on, on uneven ground, and not everything constitutes a slippery slope. And in a case like this, when the administration is in many instances breaking norms and probably laws, I think we need to focus on the clear instances first, because there's plenty to be done.
So, Mark, then let me ask you this question. Nick, I'm sorry. I know you're going to go next, but let me ask you this one question, though. What do you remain silent on then? The freezing out of the press, the scooping up illegally of people who are here legally and being deported to concentration camps in foreign countries, to side deals with Russia. I mean, where I understand, your argument about being focused, but which one of our civil liberties do we give up first in order to protect what?
Well, let's focus the discussion on what we're talking about.
Okay.
The initial objection to the AP, the court said you can't exclude the AP because they want to call the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, you're limiting their free speech. Right. I think that's perfectly a perfect reaction on the part of the court. When the administration says the media landscape is changing, and we're, by the way, they're not excluding the AP. They're saying that the slot that was once assigned to three outlets, including the AP, is now going to be reassigned to a broader group, which means the AP is going to get in there less often. To me, the reassignment of that slot, there are arguments for it that are apart from what the administration's presumed motivation is. And to me, that's probably okay. That's probably legal. So I'm going to put that one aside, and I'm going to take up my sword for other more egregious violations, including the ones you enumerated.
I think both things are true. Right. And I think Bob said it in isolation. This particular move doesn't really rise to the same level as people being removed from this country illegally and sent to die in a foreign prison. Right. I do also think we're edging closer and closer every day with each of these moves, with the efforts to defund NPR and PBS, with the efforts to rescind licenses to CBS because they don't like a story, refusing to participate in interviews, and changing the press corps, and feeding weird stories to unreliable outlets, right? Like all of these things together do start to both hinder the information that's getting to people on a day-to-day basis. That it reduces the ability of, let's take the AP, can't share news with smaller outlets in areas that have less access to the White House and less access to journalists. Now those communities become more and more isolated, and that becomes a growing endemic, right? And I think it's important that we know and acknowledge and see the impact of how these things weave together.
And I guess my concern is that I guess the best analogy that I could use is that you know, we've been on the show multiple times, and you know, we've had folks on the panel who have supported the administration, which I think is great. I think it's good for the listeners to hear both sides, but my question is, when you start to see the flames, I mean, at what point in time do you try to put the fire out? You know, I'm thinking like the idea of we had discussions in the past couple weeks about are we in a constitutional crisis? Well, no, maybe not, but then all of a sudden, you know, we're looking at a situation where the courts are now questioning the administration and the Department of Justice. Did you just ignore what the Supreme Court said? Let alone the other federal courts. And at what point in time have we allowed things to go so far that it can't be redeemed or it's more difficult? I guess as a former fire chief, I would much rather put the fire out when it's still in the trash can than after it's taken the top two floors off the building.
But my argument is this. I acknowledge that given the administration's motivations, this move is part of a slow and steady process that involves many actions on the administration's part to try and limit free speech in this country. Acknowledged. The actions that I think those in resistance should focus on are the ones that are clearly illegal, since by our own admission, we can't focus on them all. I think that's how we prevail. I understand the objection to what's being done, but I do fear that we dilute the effectiveness of not only our argument, as Aristotle would have told us, by including weaker assertions in the argument, but we also jeopardize the effectiveness of the resistance itself by not being more selective.
On that note, I would suggest that people should reach out to like elected officials about how they feel and what their opinions are on defunding NPR and PBS, for example, because those are things that we do actually have more control over and more input on and can be more effective in tackling. And it is access to those public news sources in those, again, remote and more isolated communities that is going to sort of overcome these maybe less impactful changes to who can be in press conferences. And I think that's to support Mark's argument, maybe.
Tez writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, the renaming of the Gulf was a litmus test on who will do what the administration says, full stop. It's the small things that seem like they don't matter that will, as a group, add up to the collective erosion of the free and impartial press. Not to mention, dismissing the small things allows the government to say, well, you didn't have a problem with this renaming. Why do you have a problem with XYZ, the next thing that they will propose? We need to take an underwriting break. We will return with roundtable panel after this. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning, joined by Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Please keep your letters relatively short, to the point, and on topic. And if you have time, to proofread them quickly before you click send. It's very helpful for live reading on the air. Please and thank you. Again, the email address, panel@wamc.org. Let's talk about...
Can I just go back to one point? And Mark, I really appreciate your comments. And Nick, I know you agreed with it as well. I guess the concern I have, and it goes back to the poem that came out of Nazi Germany, that when they came for the Jews, I didn't stand up because I wasn't a Jew, and when finally they came for me, there was nobody left to stand up. And in my mind, I can see there's a pattern here. Okay, you're gonna go after the press. You're gonna go after the sciences. You're gonna go after education. You're gonna go after the libraries. Okay, and in each one of these, you sort of look and go, well, it doesn't raise to the point of outrage until you realize what they've done is that who is going to stand up against them? And again, this is a clear page out of the authoritarian playbook. It's also part of Project 2025, and this is where, as a country, the question we've got to ask ourselves is how much is enough? And if you get to the point where you're pushed where it's too much, is it too late to change the tide? Like a great example is the decimation of the federal workforce. Okay, I've seen postings about those lazy employees, they finally got what was coming to them. What I worry about is as a country is that how do we restore the expertise? I've had three people that I know and care about and think really highly of who are experts in their fields. One is an expert in the area of emergency communications. Right, that person is after 30 years of service in the federal government will not go back to the federal government now. How do we replace that expertise if we're in a position to repair the damage to the federal government? And this is my concern is that we won't be able to. Okay, which means that's a public good that we will no longer be able to look at or to replicate. But it's done. And then this is just another example of an institution that is now weakened, and it's going to cost us as a country.
Nick,
yeah, I think when I'm evaluating sort of the impact of what might be considered sort of minor changes or not world-ending changes, right? Like we're taking books off of the library shelves in schools. I think about who are the most vulnerable people in that scenario, because on one hand, everyone says, well, it's not that big of a deal. You can get those books somewhere else. Maybe you can get those books at a library, but maybe you can't get them at the library because that library has already taken those same books off the shelf. Well, maybe your parents can just get the book for you, buy it for you online. And you start to see that the people who are the most impacted by each of these changes are the lowest income, the most vulnerable, the lowest access people. And when you think who is most impacted by the lack of access by the AP to be in press conferences, it's people who live in communities that can't afford their own journalists. Who's most impacted by cuts to NPR? It's people who live in communities with smaller public radio stations that can't fundraise to make up that funding gap. Similarly, legal services programs like mine, the organizations most impacted are the smallest organizations that work in the most vulnerable communities. And as much as we can sit here on the round table and we can go find our own resource, I can buy my own book, I can, pay for a subscription to the New York Times, that access gets whittled down from the people who really need it the most. And you see this information getting churned. Who is more likely to start to decline vaccines because of the change in what kind of information people have access to? The most, the populations that are less likely to get vaccines are increasingly low income, vulnerable, remote communities. That's a problem. That's the core of the problem.
And you know, where I see it are things like the administration has acted unilaterally to kill programs that Congress mandated in law. Okay, so it was passed through legislation. It was signed by a president. It became the law of the land. Thou shalt do this, and the bureaucracy was doing it. All right, then this administration comes in and says, because of DOGE, we're gonna wipe this out. All right, and Congress is not stepping up and saying, no, this was congressionally mandated. In order to wipe this out, you have got to come back to Congress, and we need to change the law. And what really bothers me is, it's not as angry as I am at Congress and the congressional leadership on both sides, on both parties. I can tell you what really bothers me is that we're treating it as if it's Congress's powers within the Constitution. It's not. It's our powers in the Constitution that our feckless members of Congress have not stepped up to make sure they're protecting our powers. We're treating it as if these are Trump's or these are Congress's. They're not. They're our collective powers. But they're being given away. And my question, again, goes back to at what point in time does the majority in the country stand up and say this isn't acceptable to give away our powers? And then the other question I have is, at what point is it a tipping point where it's too late, that we've already given up too much?
Doug writes into panel@wamc.org and says, maybe all the major news organizations should support the AP, Bloomberg, and Reuters by boycotting the White House press briefings. An attack on one is an attack on all.
And I just don't see that as a reasonable expectation that they're frenemies, they're businesses, it's human nature. But as noble as I wish the press was, I don't see that happening.
Mark, do you have any final comments on this story?
No, I guess I would say I agree with the most of the parade of horribles that have been enumerated with respect to this administration. We'll see if the courts rule the reassignment of this slot legal or otherwise. If they rule it as legal, I think the other two panelists have proven that there's plenty of things that we ought to focus our attention on to continue to defend our rights.
Diane wrote in to panel@wamc.org and says, the administration is firing so many things altogether that it does not give you the time to prioritize. And everything that is fired at us is in many ways interrelated, but you only see that if you have the stamina to pull back and rationalize everything. And then you realize that everything was dependent on each other. So Diane agrees essentially with what Bob has been saying. We also heard from Kim, who says, the reason Steve Bannon is flooding the zone, causing chaos and confusion, is to deflect everyone's attention away from the overall plan. Everything they're doing is an interconnected, overarching plan. Once everyone recognizes that, then you're strategic in tearing down and attacking the plan. It's that straightforward. I do appreciate that it is straightforward to say that, but we all agree that there is the flooding of the zone is having the intended effect, and it is hard to find the stamina, as Doug said, or the, you know, the realizations and efforts to coordinate and go forth. Panel at W. Go ahead,
I want to highlight Diane's comment, if I may, Sarah.
Sure.
I think it's really clear that with this administration, you have to use a pretty thick lens to try and refocus what they're saying and doing and get through to the truth. I also think you have to realize, as a consumer of news and information, that with previous administrations or in the future, if you find yourself without a lens in your hand to readjust what you're being told, you're probably being duped.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will return with more topics after this newscast with Ray Graff. Our panelists this morning, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Mark Whitman. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. This will be the final segment of the panel for this morning. We're going to end a little bit early to have an interview at 10:30. Joining me for the panel this morning, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Investment Banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Let us discuss a new story, this from the Washington Post. The Trump administration is using personal data normally protected from dissemination to find undocumented immigrants where they work, study, and live, often with the goal of removing them from their housing and the workforce. At the Department of Housing and Urban Development, for example, officials are working on a rule that would ban mixed-status households, in which some family members have legal status and others don't, from public housing, according to multiple staffers who spoke on the condition of anonymity out of fear of retribution. Affiliates from the U.S. DOGE services are also looking to kick out existing mixed-status households, vowing to ensure that undocumented immigrants do not benefit from public programs, even if they live with citizens or other eligible family members. The push extends across agencies. Last week, the Social Security Administration entered the names and Social Security numbers of more than 6,000 mostly Latino immigrants into a database that it uses to track dead people, effectively slashing their ability to receive benefits or work legally in the United States. Federal tax and immigration enforcement officials recently reached a deal to share confidential tax data for people suspected of being in the United States illegally. The result is an unprecedented effort to use government data to support the administration's immigration policies. That includes information people have reported about themselves for years while paying taxes or applying for housing, believing that that information would not be used against them for immigration purposes. Legal experts say the data sharing is a breach of privacy rules that help ensure trust in government programs and services. And I believe for this one, we shall begin with you, Nick Rangel.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, this story's been developing for several months now, right, because we've known that there was a targeted effort to find and identify where lawful immigrants and undocumented immigrants are, where they are located, where they're working, where they're living. And there's been concern about DOGE having unprecedented and legally murky access to these systems. And, you know, we've been following this. So, like, this is kind of a evolution of where we saw DOGE starting out. I think what a lot of organizations who serve our most vulnerable populations are really concerned about is that we've been following the rules. The rules have been set by Congress. In the HUD situation, for example, Congress decided that benefits could be provided to a household with mixed status in a proportion to the people living there who were eligible. If an undocumented person lives in a 5-person household, then the benefits to that household are reduced by that one person. So 4 people have access to those benefits. And the 5th person does not, right? And that's kind of how the household proportion works. What DOGE is doing is using the processes that were authorized by Congress and by our states and the eligibility criteria, the reporting requirements imposed by law against the households that truthfully reported the people who were in their household because they were trying to follow the law as well. And like, this becomes both a tremendous breach in data and privacy and confidential information, right? We're talking about not just households that are low income, but households with domestic violence backgrounds, households with veterans, households with people with disabilities. Like, these are people who are already vulnerable to all sorts of issues. And now we're saying we've turned this information over in a way that will allow for the removal of people. And you just will never be able to redo the trust there. It feels like not just a breach in trust, but just a tremendous backslide, where we've been trying to work in really hard to reach communities and saying, it's okay, you have to trust us. We just need this information for reporting, but no one else will get it. No one will find out outside of these legal parameters. And this administration's just blowing all of that to pieces. And I think it's really tragic in a lot of ways.
Mark Whitman.
I generally agree with Nick's assessment here. And I think about the IRS. You know, technically, let's say you were selling marijuana before it was legal. You had to report it to the IRS, and the IRS wanted to collect taxes on that activity, assuming it was profitable. And my understanding of the laws around information sharing is the IRS could not share that information unless you consented or they had a court order regarding that activity. And so the question is this: you know, there are lots of times in this, lots of instances in our nation when we want people to report things to the authorities, despite the fact that we don't want, despite the fact that what they're doing may be illegal or involved in activity that's on the margins of what's proper. And what the Trump administration is doing is consuming that trust for their own benefit, principally, frankly, to make a show of trying to get the deportation numbers up. But the cost of that could be grave, particularly if you think about, you know, individuals who are here without proper documentation who become afraid to report abuse or other crimes that they witness. So I think this all goes back, unfortunately, to the need for our country to have a comprehensive reform with respect to immigration, so that these lines about what can be shared by different government organizations and when are better delineated. Unfortunately, the Trump administration is trying to capitalize on these ambiguities in order to bolster its image to its base, in exchange for eroding trust and presumably reducing the safety and security of a number of Americans and those who are otherwise in this country.
It also bothers me that when they've gathered all of this information, this group, this DOGE group, okay, we don't know where this data has gone. Okay, I have no faith that this data isn't being shared on private servers, that it's not being parked elsewhere. And for folks at home who are saying, well, you know, why is this a big deal? So let me ask you this: what's next? What happens when they start to take the political donors list, which we're, you know, you're required when you give political donations to sort of report that, and they start to pair that with IRS records? And I don't know if anybody has seen, but the new interim head of the IRS is, shocker, shocker, the same IRS employee that was going after Hunter Biden. So the idea of politicalization of this becomes a really dangerous situation. And Mark, I agree with you that you know, not only does Congress need to change the laws you were speaking of, there needs to be a comprehensive look at data protection. Because our laws have not kept up with the changes in technology, and as I've said on the show before, I would argue, I mean, fundamentally, government shouldn't run like a business. Okay, it should run like a government, and the two are different. And again, you can back me into a corner and say, oh, so you're supporting inefficiencies? Yes and no. Okay, I'm not supporting waste. However, there are certain protections in the inefficiencies of government systems to be able to talk to each other that was a protection of our civil liberties. And these systems were purposely designed not to be able to talk to each other. Doge has now blown through that, is collecting this data, and there's no guarantee of where and how that data will be used in the future. And I can't say that it's going to stop with the immigrant community. Although everything that was said by both Nick and Mark is correct. You know, I want you to think about an environment where if you are concerned about someone in your household who may even have legal immigration status right now, but we're blowing through that, right? That shows you that there's, you know, what the administration has done shows you there's no defense. Are you going to report crimes? Are you going to report the fact that businesses have taken advantage of you? The answer is no. And what really worries me is that the government is purposely designing a system that is creating fear in our communities. And at the most fundamental level, that's wrong.
Nick?
I am curious how much analysis there's been on sort of the fiscal impact of kind of the immigration fiasco. We have people who are authorized to work, who have Social Security numbers, who contribute $96.7 billion in Social Security payments that are basically being disappeared from the workforce, either out of fear or action. We have we're spending what we've already spent, about $500 million in current this year's deportation efforts. We are sending millions of dollars, $8 million to El Salvador to imprison people, and asking El Salvador to build more prisons, right? So we're like spending even more money in a foreign country to a corporate entity that is not here, right? And we're dismantling this, the industries that rely on immigrants and migrant workers, rightfully or wrongfully, or I'm not making a statement about that, but you know, we're about to go into track season in Saratoga, and we're seeing ICE raids. In how does that impact that tourist season? Not that we should rely on undocumented labor. We should have a pathway to citizenship and authorized, authorization to be here, right? But instead of passing a Dreamers bill, we passed DACA, right? And so we have all this information for all these people who've been here for decades, who've been here, who have families, and we're just saying we're just going to attack the whole thing. Meanwhile, actual deportations are down, which is super interesting. So it's like an image of extreme enforcement, but not the action of extreme enforcement. But it is having an impact. Like construction sites are having a problem. Farms are having a problem. Tourist industries are having a problem. And I think all of this is really going to start to come to bear, notwithstanding also the fact that we're undermining trust in all of our benefit systems.
But and I'd be interested, Mark, in your perspectives on this. But don't you think that this is all going to be hidden by the tariff noise, the fact that the downturn in the economy can now be explained away as part of our noble fight against China and as part of the tariff? So being able to tease out the fact that this failed approach to immigration, this crackdown on immigration, is negatively affecting Congress. Instead, what he's come out and said is, "Suck it up. This is medicine that you need to take." And it's hiding the impact of all of these other effects on the economy.
I think it's actually magnifying the other effects. I mean, if you lose your workforce and the cost of importing the parts of the thing you need to have, or reducing the access to foreign markets. You know, we're starting, like, if China refuses to import beef and also beef farms have no one to work on their farm, those farms start to disappear. And I think they'll be able to see we have two problems. We have nowhere to send our product and also no one to produce the product here.
Mark?
I would highlight the following. I think what we face in this country and what Donald Trump and his acolytes are exploiting is the issue that we've operated in a number of areas based on ambiguity, which was permitted for political expedience. And it boils down even to the simple question of, you know, who's breaking the law and who's not with respect to immigration. If you remember, I think there's been at least one administration that has assured folks who are irregular immigrants that we will not go after someone just because they are in this country without proper documentation. And now that Donald Trump is in charge, he has said, he and the right basically say, well, if you're here without proper documentation, you're a criminal by definition, and therefore are someone that the government should take pains to find and remove expeditiously. And the reason this exists, and by the way, the reason DACA exists, and I think, Nick, DACA has never been passed. It was an executive order and remains only such, is that politicians, you know, those that are actually directly responsible to us geographically, have benefited from operating in this world of ambiguity, and we have left ourselves as a nation open to the exploitation of this by the Trump administration and a bunch of folks who are willing to do things that, frankly, I believe are ethically questionable. And many of their actions are, again, probably illegal. But I think this all goes back to the fact that too many of our politicians like to collect checks, accolades, and respect, but don't like to do their job, which is actually legislate.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark, I agree with you. And Nick, I guess what worries me is that for most people, when you go to the supermarket and all of a sudden you see the cost of beef, using your analogy, is up, how many people are going to say, oh, this is a direct relationship, there's a direct correlation between this and immigration, versus this is a tariff and this is what Trump said that we just have to suck up because it's in the long term it allows us to stand up to China.
Bob, I think there's a couple of things worth mentioning on that point. Number one is, I don't think people are in the mood to suck up inflation, given, frankly, what we're coming out of in terms of the inflationary period that led up to this administration. So I don't think people are going to see this as patriotic and start planting victory gardens and saying, I'm going to swallow this for the good of the nation. Secondly, I actually think that tariffs are it's pretty easy to determine or get a rough estimate as to what the tariffs lead to in terms of inflation in this country. The one thing that I will mention is it's a one-time hit. But again, I don't think the populace has any tolerance for that. With respect to the immigration crackdown, it's tough because we just said the number of deportations is down. So that would argue that there shouldn't be an economic effect. But I think we all have to acknowledge, and I've seen it in Poughkeepsie, if you go to the place where you hire day laborers, or if you go to the mall where you see families enjoying themselves on the weekend, there are a group of people who looks to me like they've made themselves less visible because they are afraid, whether or not they're citizens, to be tied up in any of this enforcement or this pseudo enforcement that we're seeing. So there may be an effect on the economy, but I would say that effect is far more muted if it existed in isolation than the tariff effect. But the good news for the resistance generally is I think any whiff of additional inflation will become ever more politically difficult for this administration. And I think that's why, part of why, you know, Trump has already started to retreat from his initial plan in terms of the severity of the tariffs that he was aiming for initially.
I mean, I will say that the enhanced coverage of the immigration practices of this administration is at a level I've never seen before. And it is interesting to see people to hear from people who have not paid very much attention to the fact that we've always we have a long history of accidentally deporting people who were not supposed to be deported. We have a long history of ICE raids. We have a long history of using fear tactics to keep immigrants sort of in check, right? Like, this is not, none of this is actually new. What is new is the coverage. What is new are the attacks on students. What is new are the higher profile deportations, if you call them, or removals, right? I think though that piece is new, and I do agree that that piece is intended to create fear. And in the context of accessing information about clients through the databases that providers are mandated to keep, it will have a chilling effect on low-income families seeking benefits that they have a right to have and access, and their ability to remain stably housed or stably fed, to keep their kids in school, to avoid homelessness. And so the impact, again, is still only and mostly going to be on the most vulnerable people. You're going to have people unwilling to report domestic violence because there are ICE agents being used in police departments to fill vacancies on Long Island, right? And so people are going to be less visible, but their suffering will be exponentially worse.
It's you know, and I'm going to take it back to the very beginning of the show. This is why we need a strong press. We need we need free press, open press. We need more access. We need to question government more. So when you talk about all of these issues, I mean, in the complexities of, like, the impact on the economy of these policies, that's why necking down on the press's access because the administration doesn't like to be questioned is so important. And you know, you made the comment, Sarah, about the interrelationship of these. Our civil liberties are all interrelated. Okay, and my concern is this: the minute you start to unpeel one because it's slightly less popular than the others, is that it's going to leave the ability to untangle the others as well.
Mark, final comments for the show this morning?
Look, I have profound fears about what happens if the resistance isn't far more effective in this country than it's been. You think about, you know, people being all, you know, almost effectively disappeared into El Salvadorian prisons. And, you know, it's not that long ago that there were countries in Latin America that took undesirable people up in planes and decided just to drop them in the ocean. You just wonder, you know, is it really a stretch that this administration might well say to the government, well, we were beyond the U.S. boundaries, and so it's not yours to question what happened to that person once we left. I have profound fears, and to emulate Bob and to go back to the rest of the show, I think we need to be very focused on the activities and the actions. There are so many of them that are clearly illegal. I think we get the greatest return as we push back from focusing on those.
Nick?
I thought Mark had the last word.
He had his last word. Bob, do you have anything?
Look, I do think, go ahead, Nick, I do think that we need to, as difficult as it is, and I think a writer said this earlier, that it's just the flood the zone approach, and it's really difficult to have the stamina to keep an eye on all of the balls.
They are very effectively executing that plan, yes.
But there is a network of people and organizations and entities that are helping to hold different balls in the air at the same time. And, you know, I think what is really crucial right now is to do what you can do, be as informed as you can be informed, take care of your health and mental health, because this is this, like, we're in it for the long haul, and it hasn't even been 100 days with this administration and with the changes that we've seen. And I think there'll be more. I mean, I don't have to say I think. There will be more challenges. Things will be more difficult for more people, and particularly the most vulnerable people. And those are the people that need our voice and our help the most.
Nick Rangel is the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
And these views are my own.
And these views are her own. Joined this morning by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, and our hero, our understudy for the morning, Mark Whitman, investment banker on Wall Street down in Poughkeepsie. Thank you, Mark, for joining us again. Thank you all for being here, of course, but we really appreciate a last minute pull in. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Sarah.
Happy to be helpful.
We'll return after this.